Hey, and welcome to FutureThinkers.org, a podcast about the evolution of technology, society, and consciousness. I'm Mike Gilliland.
And I'm Yuvia Ivanova. If you're new to the show and you want to get a list of our favorite books, popular episodes, and to join our community, go to FutureThinkers.org/start. All Future Thinkers episodes are now on video. To watch the premiere of each episode and join the discussion live, subscribe to our YouTube channel at FutureThinkers.org/YouTube.
Hey guys, we're excited to host Rupert Sheldrake on the show today. He is a biologist and author best known for his hypothesis of morphic resonance, which we discuss on this episode. We also talk about paradigm shifts in science, psi phenomena, experiments in consciousness, and about his new book called Ways to Go Beyond and Why They Work, where he describes some of the most well-known spiritual practices for altering consciousness. For all the links and resources mentioned in this episode, go to futurethinkers.org/92. Check out A Course in Personal Evolution, Adapting Age-Old Wisdom for a Modern Life of Purpose and Meaning. Go to futurethinkers.org/evolution. Rupert, fantastic to have you on the show. Really appreciate you joining us, and we're excited to talk about some of the subjects that you've been talking about for many, many decades now. So I hope it's not boring for you. It's super entertaining for us.
I'm glad to be with you.
So maybe we can start, can you walk us through the concept of holographic memory and morphic resonance?
Well, yes, I don't normally call it holographic memory, actually. I call it morphic resonance. Morphic resonance is the idea there's a kind of memory in nature, that the so-called laws of nature are more like habits. Each species has a kind of collective memory on which all individuals draw and to which they contribute. And even normal memory, our normal memories, I think, are not stored in our brains. I think that we resonate with ourselves in the past. So there's a kind of resonance across time based on similarity. And that's what I call morphic resonance. The word morphic means form or shape. Resonance is about similar patterns of vibration or activity. And this hypothesis, which I first put forward in 1981 in my book, A New Science of Life, makes a lot of testable predictions, and many of them have been tested. For example, if rats learn a new trick in Boston, Massachusetts, rats in Edinburgh, Scotland, and Melbourne, Australia, should be able to learn the same trick quicker just because the rats have learned it in Boston. There's a kind of resonance on the basis of similarity. And oddly enough, there's already evidence from a long series of experiments done with rats in those three places that this effect actually happens. And we're not talking tiny effects, 2% above chance. We're talking, a tenfold increase in rates of learning. The same theory predicts that average human intelligence scores should be going up in intelligence tests, not because people are getting smarter, but because so many people have done the intelligence tests before. And in fact, there's been a more than 30% increase in average intelligence over the last few decades, an effect I actually predicted in the 1980s. I didn't put the data together. Someone else did that, called James Flynn. It's called the Flynn effect. So this is a hypothesis that's testable, that gives a completely different way of understanding a whole lot of biological and psychological and natural phenomena. But of course, is controversial because it goes against the conventional assumption that the laws of nature were all fixed at the moment of the Big Bang, like a kind of cosmic Napoleonic code.
Yeah, and there's actually a related phenomena with inventors. A lot of the time, inventors across the world come up with the same invention at the same time, and even several centuries ago before we had instant communication.
Absolutely, yes. I mean, parallel inventions have long been noted, and usually people assume, at least in the ancient cultural ones, that people were drifting around the world on balsa wood rafts carrying information and that kind of thing. But with morphic resonance, you don't have to have a direct physical contact. It could happen anyway. And the same is true in evolution. There are many examples of convergent or parallel evolution where similar structures and phenomena have evolved in different parts of the world, like in Australia, the placental the marsupial mammals produce many parallel forms like mice and wolves and squirrels to placental mammals elsewhere in the world. And again, this could be examples of morphic resonance, patterns being transferred across space and time.
What are some of the limitations of these abilities?
Well, I don't think that morphic resonance is limited by time or space. In other words, I think it may stretch out over the universe. I think that's why atoms and molecules behave much the same way everywhere in the universe. That's normally what people assume proves there are universal laws, but I think there are universal habits instead. I don't think it necessarily falls off with time either. It might do, but I'm assuming, to make the hypothesis in its strongest and most testable form, that it doesn't fall off with time. So that means that the world would be, as it were, haunted by the ghosts of extinct dinosaurs and other extinct species. And if any egg were available that could tune into them, they could come back again. In fact, there's a whole class of mutations called atavisms, where organisms produce characteristics that remote ancestors had, but which are no longer produced. For example, human babies are sometimes born with tails, reflecting an ancestral form which no longer occurs. And morphic resonance, I think, helps to explain atavisms.
Do you think that it's possibly some sort of a multidimensional phenomena or quantum phenomenon?
Well, I think morphic resonance, no one knows how it might work. I mean, I'm proposing this is what happens, but when you come to the question, well, how does it happen? Then there are a number of theories. One of them is David Bohm's theory, based on the implicate order of quantum mechanics, which is a multidimensional order. Some people think it might work through the extra dimensions in string theory. String and M theory are leading theoretical physics concepts at the moment. One of them has 10, the other has 11 dimensions, whereas we normally think just in terms of three of space and one of time. These extra dimensions permit connections that regular science, old style science, would not permit. So it's possible they work through those. So, but there are a number of speculations as to how morphic resonance might work, but no one really knows. I think the situation's a bit comparable to magnetic and electric fields. When Faraday first proposed them in the 1840s, nobody knew how they worked. He didn't know how they worked. Then 20 years later, James Clerk Maxwell came along with his equations for electromagnetism, which everyone said, oh, great, we've now explained it in terms of maths. But his equations depended on tensions and vortices in the ether, a tenuous form of matter that was believed to pervade all space. Then in 1905, Einstein came along and said there's no such thing as the ether, and just got rid of it and came up with another set of explanations. And then quantum electrodynamics has yet another. So even within an established field of science like electromagnetism, the theories have changed, but the phenomenon remains the same. And so I'm talking about the phenomenon of morphic resonance and memory. And there could be a range of explanatory theories, and some may come in to fashion and they may go out of fashion. But what I'm primarily concerned with is not the theoretical basis, but the question of whether or not this really happens.
Right. And I actually think that is something really important for people generally to distinguish the idea from the actual phenomena. Because a lot of the time, these hardcore kind of science guys don't actually distinguish between the two. They equate them, which I find really strange.
Well, they do. There's several things that happen. First of all, there's some people who desperately need certainty, and the so-called skeptics and the scientific fundamentalists, believers in the religion of science or scientism, desperately need certainty. So something's got to be right or wrong. Right means it's in all the textbooks and taught in all the universities all around the world. Wrong, or pseudoscience, means it's not in all the textbooks and it's not on the educational syllabus. So for those kind of people, morphic resonance is pseudoscience because it's not right in the sense that being taught as the truth in every university. What it is a hypothesis. And how science works is by hypotheses, which are about possibilities. And you then investigate them and find out whether they fit the facts. They become more and more probable if they fit the facts well. But there's always an uncertainty in science, even about things that many people regard as certain. My book, The Science Delusion, called Science Set Free in the US, shows that 10 of the most fundamental assumptions of science are actually highly questionable. When you treat them as hypotheses, they don't turn out very well against the evidence. The idea that the laws of nature are fixed, which is the alternative to morphic resonance, is not really, hasn't really been tested. It's just an assumption. So what I'm looking for is what science is about is exploring possibilities, not treating things as certain or false. But the whole point of science is to explore new possibilities. And morphic resonance is a hypothesis. And it's a hypothesis that these effects happen. That's testable experimentally. There's already evidence that things like that do happen. And then there's the question of how you explain it, which is a further set of hypotheses, explanatory models. And again, as I said, those come and go within science. Even for established phenomena like gravity, Newton's theory of gravitation didn't really explain at all how matter could attract other matter in the universe. Einstein, in his general theory of relativity in the 1920s, came up with a completely different model for gravitation. But gravitation went on happening irrespective of these models.
What do you think it takes to create a paradigm shift in science for these phenomena to become accepted and to become part of the mainstream understanding?
And I was going to add to that, where do you see it going more or less into the realm of acceptance?
Well, what happens about in paradigm shifts is that as Thomas Kuhn showed in his book, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, 1962, I mean, that's what gave us this term, paradigm shift. At any given time, science is dominated by a model of reality, which is the framework of orthodoxy. And things that don't fit into that model are simply rejected or discarded or ignored. Like, for example, psychic phenomena today don't fit into the materialist model of the mind, which says it's just the brain or mental activity, is brain activity. So a lot of scientists claim that these phenomena don't exist. They can't exist because they don't fit into this model. They can't be explained by this model. Therefore, they're pseudoscience or illusory or don't exist. So everyone's come across people who are like that, who dogmatically deny these phenomena. That's typical behavior of a paradigm. Now, what causes paradigms to shift is partly that the anomalies build up. More and more things can't be explained. The biggest anomaly in current science is consciousness itself, that simply can't be explained by materialism, which says all matter's unconscious and everything's made of unconscious matter. Consciousness itself is a problem. It's called the hard problem in the philosophy of mind. That's one of the areas I think that will help to force a paradigm shift. Another is a paradigm shift because of financial or political reasons. In medicine, official medicine, mechanistic medicine, says the only kind of medicine that really works is based on drugs or surgery. It ignores all the alternative and complementary forms of medicine and the effect of the mind on healing. We know it happens through the placebo effect. But that doesn't fit into this medical, mechanistic medical model. That model is becoming prohibitively expensive everywhere in the world. Alternative therapies are on the whole much cheaper. And sooner or later, I think that the dogmatic insistence of governments and insurance companies that only mechanistic medicine is valid is bound to break down. It's already breaking down in India and China, where the governments are favoring traditional medical systems as well as Western medical practices. But really, in the end, the change in paradigm depends on funding. Right now, most scientists, I would say the majority, don't believe in the mechanistic materialist model. I mean, it's not as if they're all convinced mechanistic materialists. I worked in India for 7 years, and I came across about two or three Indian scientists out of the thousands I met who were convinced mechanistic materialists. Almost all the rest went along with us when they were at work, and as soon as they got home in the evening, turned back into being fairly conventional Hindus or Buddhists or Sikhs or Jains. None of them really believed it. And the majority of scientists in the world now are non-Western, they're Asian. Even within the West, a recent survey in Britain, Germany, and France showed that at least half the scientific population in engineering, science, and medicine have a religious or a spiritual perspective rather than being non or anti-religious. Many of them are interested in holistic medicine, exploration of consciousness through psychedelics, etc. But they can't do research on these things in most places because there's no funding. Now, if there was suddenly a fund of $1 billion for holistic scientific research, there's lots of scientists who'd like to do it. But right now, the funding is controlled both by either by governments with conventional committees or by drug companies and other corporations. And private funding to do independent research is a bit of it there. I mean, I've been funded privately for 30 years, but it's very small in relation to the whole of science. So I think a change in funding would be one of the things that would be really important today, because most scientists now depend on jobs. In the past, science was freer. In the 19th century, most scientists were not funded by governments or companies. They were funded privately. Charles Darwin, for example, was a wealthy amateur scientist, didn't have a government job, didn't have a government grant, he had no academic post. And he was free to do what he wanted because he didn't depend on committees telling him what he could do. He just did it. Nowadays, the great majority of scientists do depend on salaries and committees, and that makes them much more conservative. So funding's are definitely a big part of changing the present paradigm.
As far as changing individual minds, what role do you think psychedelics might play?
I think psychedelics have an enormous role in changing individual minds. I mean, they changed mine. When I first took LSD in 1970, I think, or 71, I can't remember. I was a mechanistic materialist and committed atheist, and thought that consciousness was nothing but the brain. Minds are what brains do. I believed in that standard slogan. And of course, taking LSD in a sense reinforced that. It's a chemical, it affects the brain chemically. But the actual experience of it was so far beyond anything I'd experienced, been told about, had learned either from traditional religion in my childhood or through my scientific education, that I realized consciousness was a vastly greater realm of potential experience than I thought before or imagined before. And that made me interested in exploring consciousness through consciousness. That's the only way you can explore it. And I then got interested in meditation and spiritual practices. I think it's interesting that the recent book on psychedelics by Michael Pollan, How to Change Your Mind, is actually called that, How to Change Your Mind. It was a bestseller in Britain and America, a number one of the New York Times bestseller list for weeks. And Michael Pollan, who says he started his inquiry as a materialist and an atheist, thinking the mind's nothing but the brain, ends up saying, well, I guess I'm still some kind of materialist and atheist, but I've completely changed my view of consciousness. I now see it as much more widely distributed in nature, not just confined to human heads. And it moves him towards a panpsychist view and more animistic view of nature, the idea there's much more mind or consciousness out there in the natural world. Now, it's not just a kind of bubble insulated inside human heads.
I know that people who are kind of skeptical of consciousness existing outside of the mind and hearing these ideas might ask, well, what is lost in death? If consciousness does continue on, what would you say from your own experience with psychedelics is lost?
Well, what's lost in death is the ability to work and live and act in a physical body. I mean, that's, you know, everyone, that's totally non-controversial. you know, when we're dead, we're not going around talking to people and doing things in the normal way. So I think that is clearly what's lost in death. If consciousness continues, then my own view is that it continues in something like a dream realm, that what might happen after we die is that we go on dreaming, but we can't any longer wake up. And if we're in a kind of dream world, then the world we're in is not unlike the world we visit in psychedelic states. It's a world of the imagination, a world of possibility. And in our dreams, just in our normal dreams, we have bodies and we can do things in our dreams, but we're not doing them in the physical world. We're doing them in the dream world. We can meet people. We can talk to people. We can meet people who are now dead. We can meet, and people do meet, saints and angels and spiritual beings in that realm, demons as well. So you can meet all sorts of beings. You're embodied, they're embodied, but not physically embodied. And so I think what happens when we die, the kind of dream world we go into depends on ourselves, our expectations, our hopes, our beliefs, our fears, our memories. So I think what happened, you know, atheists who believe that it all goes blank, maybe that's what will happen for them. You know, suicide bombers who believe that after blowing themselves up, they'll go into a kind of oasis with almond-eyed dancing girls serving them dates, a kind of paradisical state. That might actually happen for a while. If you are terribly afraid of demons and torture and torments, you might end up in a kind of nightmare realm. But you are no longer working in the normal physical realm through a physical body.
This has been such an interesting thing to ponder for me, especially after doing DMT and feeling like I've experienced the dream world where thoughts and emotions and fears and everything manifest instantly. And coming out of that, I often wondered if our day-to-day lived life in physical reality was somewhat of a training ground for the mind to get us to be able to, in a way, to slow down the process of manifestation of our thoughts so that we could get control over it. And then once we die, potentially, depending on how we did in life, the instant manifestations of our thoughts could either produce a heaven or a hell for ourselves?
Well, I think that certainly in the Tibetan tradition, you know, they actually have a practice called dream yoga where people practice lucid dreaming. And lucid dreaming is, as you know, the phenomenon where you become aware of the fact you're dreaming while you're dreaming. That gives you far greater control over the dream. Instead of being kind of passive victim of all the things that happen in the dreams, you can actually decide where you're going to go next, what you're going to do, and so on. And the reason the Tibetans cultivate this, dream yoga, is because they think that after you've died in an intermediate realm, which they call the bardo, this will be a very useful skill that will really help you instead of just being buffeted by psychic forces over which you have no control. You become more able to, you know, guide what's happening to you.
I think I read about this, and this I briefly read the Book of the Dead, the Tibetan Book of the Dead, and that's exactly, it's talked about that in that book. Mm. I remember that. So I love this kind of subject matter, but I think maybe it might be fun to go back to some of the experiments that potentially prove some of these psi phenomenon that we've been talking about.
Well, I think, you see, I think that the my view of the mind is what I call the extended mind. And actually, this is a view which is much more widely discussed now than it used to be, even within conventional philosophy of mind. The idea that our minds are not just inside our heads, but are extended beyond them. I think they're extended through fields. They're a kind of morphic field sustained by morphic resonance, part of my more general theory of morphic fields and morphic resonance. We're used to the idea of fields stretching out beyond material objects. The field of a magnet is in a magnet and stretches beyond it. The field of the Earth, the gravitational field, is in the Earth, but it stretches far beyond it, holds the moon in its orbit. It's invisible, but it has effects. the field of a mobile telephone is inside the phone. It's an electromagnetic field, but it stretches invisibly beyond the phone, which is why the phone works. And what I'm suggesting is our minds are rooted in our brains during normal waking life, but they stretch out far beyond them, just like fields of all these other things stretch out beyond the physical object. So when we look at something, like I'm looking at your image now on the screen, and anyone who's looking at our images on the screen is seeing those images outside themselves, then I'm not seeing your image inside my brain. I'm seeing it, you know, 2 feet in front of me. What I'm saying is that the images that we're seeing around us every time we look at anything are actually projected out to where they are in this mental field. The conventional view is light comes in, changes happen in the retina, optic nerves, brain, and then somehow all these images appear inside the head, like a kind of three-dimensional, full-color virtual reality display inside the brain. But no one's ever seen a display like that inside a brain. It's just an act of faith of conventional science that that's what's happening. I think, in fact, we're projecting them out. And this is not my theory. It's a very old theory. And Euclid in the 5th century BC explained how mirrors work like this, that when you look at something in a mirror, the light bent by the mirror comes into your eye, but you project out what you're seeing. And because it's a virtual, it's in the mind, it's not physical in the normal sense, it goes straight through the mirror. So you see things behind the mirror. What you're seeing every time you look in the mirror is your mental projections. Normally, if there's no mirror there, the projections coincide with the object you're looking at. But if there's a mirror, you split them. The object you're looking at and the image are separate. But normally, they can coincide. And because our minds project out and reach out and touch what we're looking at, that's why I think this becomes testable. If I look at another person from behind, they don't know I'm there. Can they feel me looking at them? As soon as you ask that, you realize this is a well-known phenomenon, the sense of being stared at. I've done lots of experiments on this, showing that people sensing it's way beyond chance. And other people have done experiments showing it even works through closed-circuit television, surprisingly enough. It doesn't even have to be a direct look at that person, it can work on their image, as indeed it can through images in mirrors. People can tell when they're being looked at through a mirror. So that's one line of research that I've done, and other people have also done. There's now a lot of evidence that a sense of being stared at is real. And for most people, this is completely acceptable. People know it's real because they've experienced it. More than 80%, more than 90% of the population have experienced it. It's believed in all around the world. Animals can feel it. We can feel the gaze of animals. And I think this ability evolved originally in the context of predator-prey relations. A prey animal that could tell when a hidden predator was looking at it would survive better than one that couldn't tell.
A friend of mine was involved in the he was a private investigator, I think. It was one of those sort of job titles. And one of the things he told me was that they would train you not to look at the person you're following. Because they would detect it.
I've heard exactly the same from private detectives. If you look at the person you're following, they feel your gaze, they turn around, meet your eye, and your cover's blown.
That's so crazy.
So you have to look at them a bit, otherwise you lose them. You look at their feet. And among practical people, you know, people involved in the surveillance industry, and indeed in martial arts, it's taken for granted that this is real. And in martial arts, you can actually train your ability to feel when you're being looked at from behind because it's useful. So that's one whole class of psychic phenomena, which I discuss in my book, The Sense of Being Stared At, and in many peer-reviewed papers, which are available on my website. And the other main one I've looked at is telepathy, which is picking up feelings or intentions at a distance. And when I started this work, I got interested because I thought that if members of a social group are linked through a morphic field, which I think they are, then they might be able to pick up each other's needs or intentions at a distance. And so I thought, well, if this is true, it should be true of animals, not just people. And so I started my research with dogs and cats. And I wrote a book called Dogs That Know When Their Owners Are Coming Home, summarizing this research. And many dogs know when their owners are coming home. They go and wait at a door or a window long before the person arrives. And I did experiments filming the dogs, so we knew exactly what they did. I had people go at least 8 kilometers away. They came home at random times that they didn't know in advance. We told them by mobile phone. They came in unfamiliar vehicles, so there were no familiar sounds or smells. The dogs still knew when they were coming home. There's a film of one of these experiments on my website. I published a lot of papers on that as well. Cats do it and quite a number of other animals. But the main human phenomenon I've looked at, by far the commonest human telepathy phenomenon, is telephone telepathy. You think of someone who then calls and you say, "That's funny, I was just thinking about you." More than 80% of people have had that experience. I dare say you're familiar with it yourself.
Yes. Right?
So the conventional view for 100 years, the so-called skeptics, have said, "Oh, well, it's just coincidence. You think of people all the time, and then occasionally one of them rings up, and you imagine it's telepathy, but you just forget all the times you're wrong." Now, that's a hypothesis. It's fine as a hypothesis, but in science, you need evidence as well as a hypothesis. And when I asked these skeptics, who I got so used to hearing this argument, I said, "Well, where's the evidence for this? You know, how much do people think about other people? How many times do they forget it?" And so forth. There was no evidence whatever. No research had ever been done. It was a pure speculative armchair argument. So in my experiments, to test that hypothesis, we have 4 callers in the basic experiment. People tell us the names of 4 people they know well that they might be telepathic with. They sit at home with a landline phone, no caller ID, they're filmed. We pick one of the 4 callers at random by a random number generator or a throw of a dice. We call that person, ask them to call their friend, and they think about them for a minute or so, and then they call them. And when the phone rings, they have to guess which of those 4 people is on the line. I think it's John. They pick up the phone. "Hi, John." They're right or they're wrong. And if they were just guessing, if it was just coincidence, as the skeptics say, they'd be right 25% of the time on average. In these experiments with hundreds of trials, they're right about 45% of the time. Massively significant statistically.
Yeah.
So we've done, this has now been replicated. It's published in peer-reviewed journals. It's been replicated at the universities of Amsterdam and Freiburg in Germany. Many people have had this experience. So I think this is I now have an online mobile telephone test that you can do with 2 other people. It's very simple. It's automated test. It only works in Britain and Italy at the moment. But anyone who lives in Britain or Italy, you can try it for themselves. It's free. It's fun. You do it with 2 other people. So I think this phenomenon, these psychic phenomena, telephone telepathy, the sense of being stared at, psychic dogs and cats, are incredibly common. These are almost everybody has experienced them or knows someone who's experienced them. And yet, the minute you move within the so-called established science world, you encounter a culture of total denial. You know, they've got no evidence against them. The evidence in favor of these things is overwhelming, but they pretend there's no evidence for them. They say, "Well, there's no evidence, not a shred of evidence for these things. It's all make-believe. It's pseudoscience. It's delusory." Pure rhetoric. It's like climate change deniers or like creationists. It's that kind of closed mind, dogmatic thinking, which is particularly shocking, I think, when it comes from people who claim to be scientific and believe in evidence. That's what shows that we're dealing here with a dogmatic faith position rather than an open-minded scientific one.
Do you think that part of it is that people are just scared of the unknown? They're scared of something bigger than themselves that they can't control?
I don't think most people are scared of that. I mean, when I talk about these phenomena, you know, to friends, dinner parties, you know, groups of family gatherings, that kind of thing, most people aren't scared at all. They're intrigued. And they say, well, that happens to me, or my dog does that, or, you know, I feel that, or that always happens to me. You know, most people are intrigued. They say, yes, these things happen. They happen to me. They happen to my family. They happen to my friends. All around the world, most people recognize that they happen. But they know that if they're in the presence of university professors or Richard Dawkins or something, they have to pretend that they don't believe in them, or at least not mention the subject, because they know they'll be treated with scorn and derision.
They'll be labeled a heretic.
And treated as fools or idiots or superstitious or heretics. So most people just keep quiet when they're around dogmatic skeptics. But as soon as there's no dogmatic skeptic in the room, most people aren't scared of talking about these things at all. They talk about them all the time. You know, whenever I go to parties and things, people often come up and start telling me stories about their dogs and cats. They don't find it at all scary or spooky. They just find it intriguing and interesting. And most of them, what they find mysterious is that so many scientists refuse to look at the facts. They find that the surprising thing, not that these phenomena happen.
So is it that people are just afraid to lose their positions and their funding, the scientists?
I think it's partly fear. The scientists who don't believe in the mechanistic materialist worldview just keep quiet in public. You know, I compare it to the situation in Russia under Brezhnev. You know, when you had an official communist ideology, if you went against it in public, you were classified as insane and put in a psychiatric institution. So most people just kept quiet. You know, when there were speeches at central party congresses, you know, thousands of people in these big halls would all clap dutifully and sort of stuff. But when the communist empire fell, how many people really believed in it? Some did, a minority, but certainly not most people. And I think it's like that in science, that most scientists keep quiet in public because they're afraid of being attacked. But in private, you know, with friends and family in the evening after a glass or two of wine, most of them are perfectly prepared to say these things happen to them. I mean, I have this experience the whole time. If I discuss these in a seminar room in a university, people keep very quiet. There's a kind of embarrassed silence. But in the sort of reception afterwards, if I stay for dinner, the conversation livens up and people start telling all these amazing stories about their dogs, their cats, their own experience, etc., precognitive dreams. You know, people are afraid to talk in public, but they're not afraid to talk in private about these things. The people who are afraid are the people who built their whole identity and worldview on a dogmatic, materialistic basis. And those people are usually militant atheists. They've created their self-identity as being against religion. A lot of them actually attack religion and spiritual topics a lot of the time. And they think that they can be against religion because they've got a better worldview, one that says all this is rubbish. And that worldview is scientism, materialism. For them, their whole identity, their whole worldview depends on this belief. And they're the ones who are the most threatened by it. But as I say, I think they're actually a minority, even within the world of professional science. No more than 25% in our surveys in Britain, Germany, and France recently are believers in that atheistic worldview. And of that 25%, only a minority are actually militant atheists, and you know, some of them are quite lukewarm believers, and it's just sort of lip service and scratch the surface, and they don't really believe it very deeply.
Right. Do you think that atheism is on the decline right now?
I think it's on the increase in the sense that schools and the whole educational system, at least in Britain, is largely atheistic. And if children go to school come from a religious family, the whole culture of the school is one of materialistic atheism. That's the kind of secularist worldview. So this is still being communicated to large numbers of young people as the default worldview of any educated person. So there's massive conversion to this point of view going on through the educational system. I think in among people who think about these things rather than who passively absorb them, I think there's much more doubts about militant atheism, partly because militant atheists like Richard Dawkins, I think, have brought the whole movement into disrepute through being obviously dogmatic and bigoted and strident and narrow-minded, and partly because through the growth of secular forms of spirituality, meditation, yoga, psychedelic experiences, and others, which I discuss in my recent books, Science and Spiritual Practices and Ways to Go Beyond and Why They Work, there's now an enormous number of people taking part in spiritual practices, which convince them, not through logical arguments, but through personal experience, that there's something more than our own consciousness, that we're part of a more than human consciousness, or many forms of consciousness in the more than human world. And so I think increasing numbers of people are realizing that. So I think we've got two movements going on at the leading edges of thought. I think atheism's losing its appeal. It's sort of outdated. It's threadbare. It's not very attractive. Other things are much more exciting and interesting. But at the kind of mass market level, it's probably still gaining ground because of the enormous inertia built into the educational system. No one would ever hear about any of these ideas in alternative science that we've been discussing in any normal school or university, anywhere in Europe or America, or indeed China or India. It's not on the curriculum. It's not part of the educational. And the dogmatic skeptics make sure that these things are rigorously excluded from the educational agenda. But when people undergo a kind of recovery phase from their education, you know, usually in their 20s, those are the kind of people who look at your program, I imagine, are sort of recovering from materialistic education.
Great.
Then I think people realize there's something more going on. In fact, I think that, you know, I think we might see in the future sort of 12-step materialist recovery groups on every university campus, you know, because it takes a long time to free yourself of this indoctrination.
We might hear the expression, "Oh, good, his materialism has gone into remission." So I wanted to talk a bit more about your new book, Ways to Go Beyond and Why They Work. So maybe you can tell us a bit about that.
It's a discussion of seven different spiritual practices, which have been investigated scientifically. So it's a sequel to my book, Science and Spiritual Practices, which looks at another seven. In the first book, I look at things like meditation, connecting with nature, pilgrimage, singing and chanting, gratitude. In this new book, the first chapter is on sports, which many people find surprising because sports aren't normally seen as a spiritual practice. And yet, what I argue is in the modern world, they're the main way in which millions of people go beyond their own normal everyday state of consciousness. The whole point of meditation is to shut down the default mode network in the brain, the chattering mind, the internal dialogue, and come into the present. But if you're playing a game of football and you're waiting for someone to pass a ball and the game's fast moving, you're totally in the present. If you're 50 feet up a cliff face without ropes, you're totally in the present. If you're skiing downhill at 80 kilometers an hour, you know, you go around a corner and you could go over a cliff if there's an obstacle in the way and you've got to react instantly. You're totally in the present. So I think that sports are one of the ways in which people can experience this being of completely present. And this is one of the first steps in a spiritual experience. Some people actually undergo dramatic spiritual revelations in the context of sports. So that's one chapter, and I look at the studies on the psychology of sports and surveys of people's experiences and so on, and the physiology. Of course, it also involves changes in hormone levels, you know, testosterone, adrenaline, and so on, and serotonin. So there's plenty of physiological correlates. The next chapter is on psychedelics, and I think there's now a lot of scientific research on psychedelics, a resurgence of this research, which looks at, you know, the effects on people's subjective experience, the effects on people's long-term well-being. Some psychedelics help people with addiction problems or people who are going to die. They can help liberate them from the fear of dying. So they're used now therapeutically. There's increasing numbers of research programs on this.
Yeah, and for PTSD and depression, they can be fantastic.
Exactly. For those kinds of things, that there's now quite a lot of research on that. And in fact, a ketamine analog was recently approved just last week for use in depression. It's the first new class of antidepressants for decades.
Yeah, I saw that.
So there's that evidence. There's also the evidence from people's own experience that for many people it's an opening to a spiritual realm. Certainly was for me, and I know many people for whom that's been the case. And then, of course, there's the brain scans that show which bits of the brain are affected and so on. So I'm not arguing that psychedelics are good for everybody or that they don't have dangers, but I am arguing that they can be. And in the modern world, for people, especially people brought up in a kind of materialistic secular world, they can be a very important rite of passage which open their minds to the fact that minds are more open than they've been led to believe. Then I have a chapter on fasting, by which I mean not having food. Some forms of fasting involve, like Muslims in Ramadan, not having drink either during daylight hours. But the kind I'm more interested in is just the food, going without food for days or more. It's something I do myself every year, and done it for 30 years or more. And there's a lot of research on fasting, the physiological effects, the mental effects. It usually gives greater mental clarity and more vivid dreams.
How long do you do it for, usually, yourself?
Minimum of 3 days, sometimes seven. I always do it during Lent. I do it in Holy Week, just leading up to Easter, which is the most traditional time in Western culture to do it. This year I'm planning to do it for 4 days, just water.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I take vitamin supplements and things to avoid vitamin deficiencies, and psyllium husks to avoid no fiber in the gut. They're non-nutritional supplements. Otherwise, just water and tea. And there's a huge amount of research that shows not only the spiritual benefits of this, which is why it's present in every spiritual tradition, Hindus, Muslims, Jews, Christians, every tradition has fast, shamanic cultures, they all have fasting. But there's a lot of physiological research that shows it cleanses the system, all sorts of senescent cells that don't normally get cleaned up and cause inflammation are flushed out, toxins in the fat stored in the fat cells. It's detoxifying physically as well as spiritually. And I personally think, even in a secular context, that fasting is the single most effective intervention that most people could bring into their lives, and it would enormously reduce the cost of healthcare systems if they encourage fasting. It helps cure diabetes, it flushes out and detoxifies the system. Again, not for everybody. It's not recommended for children, anorexics, people on very complex multiple medications, etc. Then I have a chapter on prayer and the nature of prayer and the effects of prayer. And again, this is something found in every tradition. And even as recent surveys show that even in modern secular Europe, where most people don't go to church or have any regular religious practice, far more people pray than actually go to church. It's a very common practice, and it always has been. So I look into that, what's going on. There's lots of evidence that people who pray sleep better, are happier, healthier, and live longer. Then there's the question, well, does it really work? Well, it certainly works if through the placebo effect. You could say, well, it's nothing but a placebo. But the fact is, placebos work. If you call it a placebo effect, it may be just rebranding it. But if you have, in drug trials where you have placebo, drug, and no treatment, the placebo often works as well as the drug, but both of them work better than no treatment. And so if you say, well, prayer is nothing but a placebo effect, then placebo effects work much better than nothing. So anyway, I have a discussion of the nature of prayer. I have a chapter on holy days and festivals, which are part of every culture, secular and religious, that there are times when people can be together, celebrate together, express a kind of spiritual connection with each other and with nature. I think they're vital for social and individual mental and spiritual health. And of course, they've been eroded through secularism, the 24/7 culture, which makes no distinction of any time. Every day is a shopping day, an internet day, a Facebook day, etc., equally all the time. And I think that the Jewish people are the ones who are the best proponents, really, of the importance of sacred time. I mean, even secular Jews often observe the Sabbath, at least have a meal together as a family on Friday evenings, which is a very important part of their celebration of the festival. It's about being together with friends and family, and celebrating together. And interestingly, as I point out in my book, in modern Europe, there's been a revival of some of the ancient midsummer festivals.
Yes.
In the form of summer music festivals. You know, they, in a sense, recreated that space which in the Middle Ages was celebrated all over Europe around Midsummer's Day. All over Europe, St. John's Day, 24th of June, there were huge summer festivals, celebrations, fun. And the Glastonbury Festival in England is almost always timed to fall over Midsummer's Day. So it actually recreates this midsummer celebration in a genuine festival spirit. And I have a chapter on practicing virtues, avoiding vices, and being kind, because all these spiritual practices really, in the end, have to be in the context of helping other people and helping make the world a better place. Otherwise, they're purely self-indulgent.
Yeah, absolutely.
Or spiritual consumerism.
Yeah, very interesting, actually, with a lot of these practices that you mentioned, we've recently been talking about on our podcast, and a lot of them have scientific backing behind them, like the practicing virtues one. Jonathan Haidt talks about that in his recent book quite a lot, that regardless of whether of any kind of, you know, return on your investment into these practices, it actually makes people happier if they do it. It gives them meaning.
Definitely. I mean, that's one of the things that in my book, Ways to Go Beyond and Why They Work, the research on these things shows that they make people happier. They make people happier because they make them feel more connected. And generally speaking, happiness is to do with feeling in the flow, connected, being present. And unhappiness is to do with being out of the flow, disconnected, alienated, bored, not present. And so spiritual practices are really all of them about different ways of feeling more connected to the present, to a greater consciousness beyond our own, to each other, to nature, and to being in the flow of life and spirit. I mean, that's what they're about. And that's why they work. And every religion has its own combinations of spiritual practices and encourages them. And of course, you can do them outside or within a religious framework. So the way I see it is not that you have to be spiritual or religious. You can be spiritual but not religious, and you can be religious but not spiritual. But I think personally, best to be religious and spiritual. So that's my own particular path. I follow a Christian path, and I do these practices within that context. But I wouldn't be very interested in the Christian path if it didn't have these spiritual practices. I think it's about the practices, about the experience, much more than about doctrines, ideas in books, and so on.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point, that all of these practices have to do with connecting to someone or something beyond yourself, rather than just kind of selfish, you know, self-improvement, which is how they've been often reframed in the Western context, where, you know, meditation is about, you know, becoming better, more efficient, or, you know, sleeping well so that you can earn more money. Or, yeah.
Yes, exactly. I think they're often portrayed that way, and I think people often do them for those motives to start with. But then when they start having experiences of being connected with something greater than themselves, their mind being part of a greater realm of consciousness, then I think it may help them go beyond that framework of thinking. So I think it's certainly better to start spiritual practices even with these rather limited motives than not to do them at all, because I think they can lead on beyond that. There are a lot of atheists who meditate now. I mean, Sam Harris is an example of a militant atheist who actually meditates. And I suspect that, you know, if he keeps at it, that his views of consciousness will change. They're already beginning. He's already sort of backtracking a bit on hardline materialism and sort of saying he's looking for other ways of scientific, broader scientific views. And panpsychism is probably where he'll go next. That's where many materialists go when they move out of materialism to kind of panpsychism, the idea there's consciousness throughout nature, which is recognizing something beyond themselves. And so I think, in fact, materialism constantly tends to lead in that direction through experience. So I think we're in the middle of a very interesting period of transition, because new school atheists and materialists are actually taking up spiritual practices themselves. Old school atheists and materialists like Richard Dawkins, we have nothing to do with them, except perhaps the one that they might have acknowledged at least in part is connecting with nature. They all connect with recognition, but they think nature is inanimate and mechanical, so it's hard to form a deep relationship with something that's totally unconscious. So I think what's interesting now is that it's a completely new phase of spiritual evolution, when we have people who are coming out of a materialist atheist background taking up spiritual practices, and those practices themselves may, through their own experience, lead them on to challenge that worldview and to look for broader worldviews that go beyond it. So I think that's part of the paradigm shift that's happening.
Rupert, this has been a lot of fun. I'm really happy you joined us here.
Good. It's been fun talking to you both.
All right. That was our interview with Rupert Sheldrake. To check out his books and all the resources we mentioned in this episode, go to futurethinkers.org/92. And if you want to stay up to date with our latest episodes, blog posts, or news from Future Thinkers, join our mailing list at futurethinkers.org/mailing-list. To meet like-minded people, join our Future Thinkers Discord community. Go to futurethinkers.org/discord.
Check out A Course in Personal Evolution, adapting age-old wisdom for a modern life of purpose and meaning. Go to futurethinkers.org/evolution.
Don't forget to subscribe and hit the bell icon to get notified of new videos. You can also follow us on social media to stay connected. If you'd like to get a t-shirt like the new Make America Think Again, go to futurethinkers.org/store. If you like what we do and you want to help us make more podcasts and videos, consider donating or becoming a patron at futurethinkers.org/support. Also visit our sponsor Qualia and use the coupon code FUTURE to get 10% off your purchase.